This is Crow's Feet, a place where we ponder the question, are these our golden years? Or does aging just suck? Well, yes, getting older is not for the faint-hearted, but aging also brings wisdom and humor, a finely tuned perspective on life. In our podcast, you'll hear the voices of more than 300 writers who will inspire you and often make you laugh about this journey through life.
My name is Warren Turner. As a United Church of Christ minister, I served many congregations and wrote many sermons and newsletters. Now retired, I enjoy being a crow's feet writer. I'm pleased today to welcome as a guest one of my co-writers, Jan M. Flynn. She's an excellent writer who comes from a very fascinating background, all the way from stage and television to a theme park where she wrote a camel, a water buffalo, a Brahma bull, and even a temperamental llama. She even became a two-term mayor of a small California town. Jan lives in Boise, Idaho, with her husband Michael Flynn, an actor and artist, their immensely patient dog Molly, and a new cat named Bandit. She is wildly proud of her two adult sons, so we won't let her get started on that. As I read her bio, it was very interesting and multifaceted, and often I stopped and reread it because I enjoyed it so much. But I won't go on and on since she's here. Jan, welcome. Tell us more about yourself.
Well, thank you, Warren. It's a delight to be here. And thank you for calling my resume interesting rather than weird. Since I know now that you're a minister, I feel a little bit like I'm in a confessional. But I did want to say that in addition to performing on stage and television and doing a circus act at one point in my misspent youth, I also spent time in education and nonprofit management, which kind of grounded me in a little more reality. And spending time as an English teacher helped with my writing. I began writing seriously probably in 2014. And I write actually mostly fiction. I write nonfiction essays for Crow's Feet and on my blog and on other publications for Medium, but I write primarily fiction. And my short fiction has appeared in a number of anthologies and literary magazines. And actually, I've won some awards. I won first place and honorable mention in Writer's Digest International Award, so that's exciting. And recently won a nice contest on Vocal.com. So that's great. And, you know, being a fiction writer is an uphill climb, but I am thrilled to say that I now am represented by an agent, Helen Adams of Zimmerman Literary Agency in New York. And it's just wonderful for a writer to have, you know, a publishing professional want to become their advocate. And she is out on submission with my first novel, The Moon Ran After Her, which is actually the story of the women in my extended family, my late husband's family, who survived the Armenian genocide. So that is out on submission. And she's also going out with another book that's also historical called Free Rain, which is much more lighthearted and takes place mostly in a roadside Wild West show in 1919. So working on that. As I warned my agent, I'm a very eclectic writer.
Yeah, it sounds like it, all the way from Armenia to our silly Wild West. But what have you chosen to write fiction for in smaller or shorter articles?
Most of my short fiction is speculative. It always has some sort of weird element. You know, maybe somebody in it is, you know, not actually there. Maybe they're a ghost, or maybe there's a bit of magic, or just something a little tweaked about it. So, yeah, my short fiction tends to be speculative and a little dark. Sometimes my kids read my stories and go, "Geez, Mom, what's with you?"
Well, kind of scary, in other words.
A little scary, a little yeah. Twisted.
Yeah. Well, Jan, how long have you been a Medium writer, and what brought you to Crow's Feet?
Well, I started writing for Medium, I believe, in 2019. I'd been blogging for a long time, but Medium obviously offered me a much bigger platform, a lot more outreach to other writers. And I believe I stumbled on Crow's Feet 6 to 8 months ago, and I was immediately really drawn to it because of the caliber of the other writers, and I thought it was so well edited and curated by Nancy Peckinham. So I began writing for Crow's Feet, and it's been a delight. And connecting with other Crow's Feet writers and being part of the podcast team has just been wonderful.
We have quite a variety of folk that write for Crow's Feet, and I think everybody could benefit from reading some of the stories in our Crow's Feet group. Tell you what, Jan, let's let you read one of your articles, then we'll go from there, okay?
Okay, well, this is a topic that I think about a lot, and I think has to do with how we age as best we can. So the title of this piece is Of Gratitude, Aging, and Toast. As I've gotten older, I've developed a nightly habit. Before I turn off my bedside lamp, I write down 5 things I'm grateful for. Not 4, not 6, always 5. And they can't be repeats. The rule of 5 is arbitrary, but the fixed number works for me. Sometimes, it's not nearly enough. Other times, as fortunate as my life is, I have to crank my brain's engine to come up with items 4 and 5. Those evenings are when my little gratitude journal does the most for me. It has a pronounced stabilizing effect on my wobbly perspective. Each night, as I look back, I find that some days are real standouts, red-letter occasions when dreams come true in real life. My cup runneth over. My gratitude journal is too wee to contain such largesse. Other days are dire and difficult, and at such times, I note whatever it is that got me through them. But most days in my life, and I suspect yours, are ordinary. Just days, one after the other. Nothing to write home about. I stare at the blank lines in my journal, mind wandering, wishing I could just nestle down and go to sleep. Those are the days when I haven't paid enough attention. If I had, I would have seen that any day plucked from my life, even the most quotidian, is studded with overlooked wonders. Which brings me to the toaster. Now, slathered with butter and jam or a perfectly squished avocado and salt, a good slice of toast is as comforting and reliable as a worn pair of slippers. Whether you're in a rush to get to work in the morning or you're in need of some unchallenging ballast for a queasy stomach, toast is there for you. All you need is a loaf of bread sitting around and a working toaster. Consider, though, life before electric toasters. The only way to turn a slice of bread into a heated, toothsome delight was to spear it with a fork and hold it over a flame. No doubt the result was often charred rather than toasted, and it must have resulted in tired arms and blistered fingers. Besides, by the time you'd gotten a second or third slice done, the first one was cold. So the first American patent for an electric toaster wasn't filed until 1906. 7 years later, the first toaster that turns toast arrived, and it wasn't until 1921 that Charles Streit, a Minnesota mechanic, received the patent for an automatic pop-up toaster, and a wedding gift cliché was born. So, toasters, as daily miracles tend to be, are easily overlooked, but think of your morning without one. For that matter, the next time you're stumbling into your kitchen on a bleak Monday morning, pause a moment. Consider the wonders that surround you. Hot and cold running water, a stove you don't have to feed with firewood, a device that keeps your food cold, and some of it frozen, if you wish, and that doesn't even require you to stock it with blocks of ice. A microwave oven that magically makes the molecules in your food dance, metamorphosing raw eggs into scrambled fluffiness and gooey batter into baked brownies, all without heating their containers. And you didn't even have to strike a match to light a kerosene lantern so you could find your way to your automatic coffee maker. So even on the worst of days, and I'm old enough to have had some pretty lousy ones, I found that looking for whatever hasn't gone completely to hell is what sustains me, and at least most of my sanity. The grace notes in life. The car that still runs, the mail that still gets delivered, the local espresso drive-thru that's always open by 6 a.m. They're like handholds and footholds on a cliff face. They offer a path, not necessarily an easy one, but one that eventually leads upwards. As for the dull days, the meh days, I have those days too. But I have less of them the longer I live. I've come too far down this road not to know that I'm surrounded by marvels, whether or not I've taken the time to register them. And I have a really great toaster.
Okay, thank you, Jen. That was great.
Thank you.
It certainly makes me think about things that I should be grateful for. And I think it would help all of us to take up your routine. I'm only about 10 feet from my toaster and some bread, so a little later, maybe I'll imbibe.
Go for it.
Right. You know, crow's feet is about aging, and those people who write for crow's feet are talking about their experiences and trying to address some of the issues that they face or that they assume that people in their late 50s, 60s, 70s and up are experiencing. You've done a lot of things and been a lot of places. How does that history help you at writing for crow's feet?
Well, I think that writing is one of those areas where age and experience are really an asset. We just have so much more to draw from. And I think those who age well share a certain characteristic, and that also helps with writing. We are more observant and appreciative, and we're way less concerned with how the world sees us and more open to what the world shows us. And I think that makes a lot of difference. And it's one reason why I think writers who have a little more experience behind them have a lot to offer.
I certainly agree with you on that. I wonder about that situation that you said about what people think about us, because I often go back and see a little story that I would like to tell, but I'm afraid it would be embarrassing or it might hurt somebody's feelings. So how do you respond to that?
That is the dilemma that I think every writer who writes creative nonfiction or memoir faces. It's always that tricky balance between telling the truth without doing unnecessary damage. I think it's something we all face. And the way we solve it is as different as there are writers writing creative nonfiction and memoir. But you do have a lot of responsibility as a writer. It's almost a godlike thing. You can create characters, you can kill people off. And in creative nonfiction and memoir, you do have to honor the past and the other people that shared it with you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, one of the things that I've observed in writing for Medium is that a lot of people pick up pseudonyms. And I think they don't want people to know that they're the one who is writing this. Has mm-hmm. that ever appealed to you at all?
No, not really. I mean, early on, I thought, well, gee, you know, should I have a pen name? And I realized that's just kind of, for one thing, it's very complicated. If you want to publish, then you are writing under a pen name and you're trying to establish yourself as an author. Do you want to continue writing under that pen name? How do you sort of brand yourself, which you really kind of have to do if you want to get anywhere in publishing? So I gave that idea up and I decided it was really kind of just chicken spit to do that. If I'm not willing to put it under my own name, I probably shouldn't be writing it.
Yeah, well, you and I had a little conversation last week about names, and my first name was George, and we called me Warren because my dad was also named George. So instead of being George Warren Turner, I went with G. Warren Turner. And so I was just kind of curious, can you reveal your middle name, what the M stands for?
Actually, yes, I will reveal that. The M stands for Mandroian, which is an Armenian name, and that was my late husband's name. So that was my first married name. You know, when I remarried, I wanted to retain some of the last name that I shared with my adult children. So I became Jan M. Flynn. The middle name I was given to at birth was Gay. So I was officially Janet Gay. You know, back in the 70s, I had to really explain to my mom why that was embarrassing, because we were embarrassed about that back then. And she said, well, that's just you and your little friends who think of it. So I had to show her the first page of the San Francisco Chronicle about the first gay rights parades and saying, Mom.
Well, you mentioned your novel about the Armenian genocide.
Yes.
We're having a terrible time in this country with gun violence. 10 people killed by a guy who believed in white supremacy and worried about people of color replacing all the white people in the world. And I just kind of curious, would you ever look at writing articles or writing another novel which would involve some of our contemporary problems?
I might indeed, but I have found it a little more approachable to give myself a certain amount of distance. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write about the Armenian genocide, was because I knew nothing about it until I became involved with my late husband, my first husband. And when I did, I thought, my God, how do I not know about this? And it was really the template that Hitler drew on for the Holocaust. And so I started looking into it, and I read firsthand survivor accounts, and they were so close to it that they were really harrowing to read. And also, you know, I would think to myself, oh my God, this is just unbelievable. And I would think, that's the problem. It's kind of unbelievable. Sometimes it's better to have a little bit of distance, even though you have a close connection to a topic, to be able to really portray it. I think that's why we see so much wonderful fiction set in World War II now. You know, it's 70 years ago. But the fact that we have some distance about it helps. So if I were going to take on something about gun violence today, which is a topic that concerns me terribly, as I know it does most thinking people, I would probably try to find a way to personalize it or couch it in a story that people could read without just being endlessly horrified, like we are when we read the news. It's numbing.
That's a good point. And as you say, a novel or a fiction article might help us see it better, because we are looking at it somewhat at a distance. Well, I want you to talk a little bit about your website and your podcast.
Well, yes, I do have a website. That's one thing that authors these days really need to do. So my website is janmflynn.net, and I hope people will feel free to visit me there. My blog is on that website. I blog weekly. And some of the stuff that I write for Crow's Feet is on my blog in another form, but you may recognize it. And then I also have a weekly podcast. I actually call it a blogcast, called Here's a Thought. And it's the blogcast for people who overthink, because that is certainly a tendency of mine. So that's available on pretty much all platforms, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. So they're short scripted essays that I've written and sort of share with the audience. And it's a lot of fun. So it's supposed to be a break for those of you who overthink, to just stop listening to the voice in your head and take a recess and listen to the one in mine.
You know, Jan, I can't stop thinking about you riding circus animals. And maybe you should tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. So my career as a circus rider was brief. It was during a summer between college years. I was home and needed to save money for the next year of college. And so I got a summer job at a theme park. And really, my job was to be a hostess. I walked around the park wearing a tunic and little, what they called hot pants at the time, little shorts. This was in the early 70s. Meanwhile, I made friends with the guy who was the wrangler for the hoofed stock in what was called the African Adventure Show at the park, which was basically a one-ring circus. And because I told him that I could ride horses, possibly I embroidered my skills a bit, but I could, he recruited me to be his relief rider for some of the shows where he didn't have enough riders to fill out his act. So for a while, I would show up backstage and change out of my tunic into one of his cowboy shirts. He was small, and his cowboy boots and a hat, and ride the Brahma Bull in the finale. The Brahma Bull was named Frosty, and he was very tame. And I would ride the water buffalo named Sarge in a middle act called the balancing act, which was meant to keep the audience entertained while those stagehands broke down the cage where the lions and tigers performed at the beginning of the show. So they would haul out this giant seesaw, and the real rider would ride out on a camel, and the wrangler would ride out on a giraffe, and they would get on opposite ends of the seesaw, and I would ride Sarge the water buffalo and get him up onto the fulcrum of the seesaw and ride him back and forth and make the seesaw go up and down. That was the big act. And then, as I said, I rode Frosty in the finale parade. So that went fine. Frosty and Sarge were really very docile, until one day I showed up backstage and everything was chaos. And it turned out that the real rider, the camel rider, and she rode other animals, hadn't shown up because her husband was in jail. So I had to ride the camel, who was very high spirited and very, very tall, besides being high spirited, and the llama, who really hated being ridden. But I managed. It was one of those summer jobs. I was lucky to survive. No, my parents never found out, but it was fun, and it taught me that you don't really have to have a boring job to make a living.
Okay. Well, Jan, I'm really honored to be able to have this conversation with you today, and think now as we come to a close of this episode, I wonder if you've thought of anything that you would like to add or something that you would like to say at the end here.
Well, just briefly, I do think that Crow's Feet is such a resource. I've been so just honored to be among these people who have so much talent and resourcefulness and perspective and humor and so much to offer. And I think that's really important. We live in a youth-obsessed culture, and you know, many cultures really revere their elders. Ours does something of the opposite. And I think it's really an opportunity and a challenge and an important thing for those of us who are aging, who are lucky enough to be aging, to really claim our place as elders, because we do have so much to offer to people that are coming up, and because ageism cuts both ways. And we need to be aware of it, and we need to really work against it and claim our place. So that's my two cents, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, that's great. That's a good philosophy about writing, and I am glad that I'm in the same writing group as you are. And I see my toast popping up over there. So let's say goodbye for today, and thanks again, Jan.
It's been a great pleasure, Warren. Thanks so much.
Today's episode was produced by me, Warren Turner. Our guest was Crow's Feet writer Jan M. Flynn. Our executive producer is Nancy Peckenham. Editing and sound design by Rich Halton. With support from Crow's Feet team, Betsy Allen, Lee Bench, Kathy Dunn Gilbert, Jean Feldeisen, and Nancy Franklin. By the way, if Jan's voice sounds familiar, it's because she's who you hear at the beginning and end of every Crow's Feet episode. In fact, here she is now.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Crow's Feet, Life as We Age. Don't miss any of our great stories. Subscribe to Crow's Feet wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to tell your friends and family to give a listen to and leave a rating or review. You can read more Crow's Feet stories online at medium.com/crows-feet. And check back next month for a new episode. So until next time, remember to savor every moment. To paraphrase Jonathan Swift, no wise person ever wished to be younger.